Chapter 1, Listening 1, How to be Innovative in Your Business.
So Phil, I guess let's start broad and tell us, you know, what is innovation and how does it differ from being creative?
Well, there's multiple components to innovation, but the innovation, the way I describe it is it's the end result of that human creativity, that human ingenuity. The ability to come up with ideas is a skill anybody can apply. But what separates the people from really the innovators is people who actually execute the ideas. They translate that creativity and that passion and the ideas they come up with into something that's meaningful, meaning it actually ships, it's a product, it's a service, it's a nonprofit to help people, whatever it is, it actually gets implemented. And that's how I define the innovation.
So you're actually saying, just so I'm clear there, what you're saying is that the difference between being innovative and being creative is the ability to implement.
Exactly. And one of the sayings I've become quite fond of is ideas without execution are a hobby. And I'm not in the hobby business.
Yeah. Like that.
Well said. I think we all know someone who comes up with lots of ideas but never executes.
We're looking at each other here, Phil. There's no shortage of ideas, is there?
No, I mean, and that's part of the challenge, right? What tends to hold people back, there's highly creative people, but what tends to hold them back is one, is that personal drive, commitment to actually be an innovator. Two, the self-doubt. Oh, someone's not going to like my idea. It's really not all that, you know, that great of an idea. And the third is getting out of your comfort zone. Innovation's about change and doing something different, right? The first time I recorded a podcast, I felt like a fool sitting in this bathroom.
Yeah.
Because it was the only quiet room in the hotel to try to do this recording with a little cheapo microphone plugged into the side of a laptop. You know, but if I hadn't started that, then I wouldn't have had the podcast. I wouldn't be where I'm at right now with my book and everything else that's happened.
I reckon, you know, and if I think of our listeners, small business owners, myself, people I've spoken to, the immediate reaction is, oh, yeah, but I'm not creative. I'm not innovative. That's for other people.
It is the most common answer I get, right? When I stand up, I do speeches and workshops. You know, there's a breakdown of the audience. About 20-25% of the people in the audience think of themselves as being creative, you know, and a lot of those guys are designers or, you know, software engineers who are on the creation side. But everybody else in the room says, I don't know, I'm an implementer, I didn't get blessed with the special DNA, you know. But it's a fallacy of innovation. Innovation's a skill that anybody can learn, anybody can practice, and anybody can become proficient at.
Yeah, okay. All right. And you're going to share with us how to do that. as quickly as you can. You've actually written a book, which we'll touch on later, which I think is fantastic, called Beyond the Obvious. And that does, I mean, all you have to do is listen to Phil's podcasts, read Beyond the Obvious, and you will break through into innovative space. And I've done that, and it's brilliant. So we'll come to that. But, Phil, one of the things that I remember you talking about very early on was this concept of the brainstorm. And I remember you describing the typical brainstorm, and it certainly had my head nodding. What's your problem with brainstorms?
Well, the problem with brainstorming is, you know, we've all done it, right? Someone in your organization says, oh, let's get 10 of our best and brightest people, and let's put them into a room. And we'll ask them to, you know, I don't know, come with a new product idea. And what happens typically is, you know, someone raises their hand and goes, oh, I'll be the scribe. I'll write it on the flip chart. Yeah, everybody starts throwing out ideas, and it's good for about 15 or 20 minutes, then all of a sudden it starts to peter out, right?
Yeah.
Well, what happens is the human brain, we are locked into this concept of once I've answered the question, I stop looking, right? And so if you ask a very simple question like, let's come up with some product ideas, and people start brainstorming, soon as in their head they think the question's been answered, the energy to keep looking goes away. I mean, one of the tests that I use or examples I use in the workshops are, you know, what is half of 13? Immediate answer everybody comes to is 6.5, and they stop looking. But 6.5 is not the only answer. Mm-hmm. If I'd written it out, you know, as letters, it would be THIR-TEN, splitting it in half. Roman numeral 13, you split it vertically, it's 11 and 2. You split it horizontally, it's 8 and 8. You know, so you've got all of these things that these answers that are beyond kind of where you obviously stop, because we're taught in school solve the problem, write it on a test, get move the on. A, and move on.
Yep.
And a true innovator is somebody who doesn't stop at the obvious answer. They go beyond that obvious answer because that's where the breakthroughs really come from. And so brainstorming sessions, you know, you kind of peter out and you really never get beyond kind of just answering, you know, the basic simple question. And then the other problem with brainstorms is you come up with 200 ideas. So what? What do you do with them, right? Someone says, oh, I'll type them up. I'll send them around in an email. And then what happens? Nothing, right? There's a massive bit bucket out there someplace with all these emails with thousands and thousands of ideas that never get executed.
And dust is attracted to those Word documents that get distributed post brainstorming sessions as well.
Exactly, and the problem is that then you just train train the people that you brought into the brainstorming session that you put all this energy into it, nothing comes of it, nothing ever happens, and you're training people not to be innovative.
Mm.
So, Phil, how do you learn to ask the right questions to inspire innovation?
Well, there are different kinds of questions, right? There are, you know, the very simple yes-no answers, you know. There's also very simple answers that are factual. Like if you asked me saying, you know, so Phil, what color car are you driving today? I don't have to go out and look, you know, in the parking lot to see what color my car is. I know what color my car is, right? Mm-hmm. It's an answer that I have in my head. There's a specific type of question. I refer to them as killer questions. These are very specific sets of questions that, one, you should not be able to answer it, you know, right off the bat. It forces you to look at the problem in a unique and different way, and it forces you to get up out of your chair and have to go through some form of a discovery process. And so these are very specifically structured questions that force you to look, again, at the problem in a way that you just never had considered before. And so the book and the podcast and the Killer Question Twitter feed are all about, you know, my process of disseminating these questions to help people kind of jar their thinking, get them out of the rut of doing what's obvious for their business. You know, in my case at HP, you know, what was the next laptop? What was the next desktop? What was, you know, mm-hmm. versus how do you break out of that rut and do something completely different?
And I just for our listeners' benefit, and Phil, we'll talk about it. I'd love you to share some what you think would be some wonderful killer questions for a small business to ask. But I love them, Phil, and I've shared them with I've done workshops around them where, you know, a typical question is what they do. Before we share a typical killer question, what they do is that they force you into uncomfortable places that you would never have considered going in order to look for solutions that you would never have found otherwise. And, you know, typical killer, my favorite killer question is the one that challenges the category. You know, you ask people to list the conventions of the category in which they operate and then to flip them 180 degrees and see what comes out. And that alone, that's gold right there.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I hear from people all the time that they've got their, you know, their own favorite killer question. And part of the, you know, what I've done here recently is I've gone through a process of rewriting the questions. I've added a whole bunch of new questions. But more importantly, the questions that I've come up with are not the final set. The whole role here is to help people come up with their own questions and to think more specifically, because questions have a very unique characteristic. If I ask you a question, you can't stop your brain from trying to answer it. For instance, when I asked you what was half of 13, your brain clicked into gear, calculated it at 6.5, and then came back to listening to me, right? So questions have a way of forcing the brain to engage, right? And as soon as you throw a curveball, meaning you give them a killer question that they can't answer, the brain all of a sudden is trying to answer it and is off into a completely different path that you normally would not be able to even perceive or force yourself to be thinking about. So that's really the one key and the power of questions. And I think it's something that we just overlook both in business and, you know, in schools and such. And really it's been this 12-year journey for me to really uncover this unique power of asking really well-thought-out questions to get unique sets of observations, answers, and discoveries.
Phil, apart from important, well, killer questions, are there other contributing factors towards innovation? You know, is there a certain type of workspace that inspires creativity and innovation? Is there a way to organise your time that mm-hmm. inspires creativity and innovation?
Well, there is. In fact, I did a podcast. This has got to be like 4 years ago. I had a listener ask about, you know, when your most creative time, right? For me, it's in the morning because it's quiet in the house. You know, I can concentrate. And I set it. And for me personally, I set aside time every day just to work on new ideas.
Yeah, right? Really?
Yeah, yeah. It's like going to the gym, right? In fact, my wife gives me a hard time because she says I spend more time exercising my brain muscle than the rest of my body. She would like for me to go to the gym. I'm like, I'm exercising. I'm just exercising a different muscle here.
You know? Exactly right. And she just can't see the well-cut brain that you have. It's hidden under that cranium of yours, but she knows it's there.
So I think people have their own kind of cycles of when they're most creative. You know, one of the things that I talk about is we think, a lot of people think of innovation as being like, you know, one person, you know, sitting in an office by themselves. But where I found the best ideas to come from is really putting together a team, whether that's a team if you're in a larger organization or if you're a small business. That team can be your advisors. It could be friends and families. It could be other small business owners that you bring together. And there's a unique way of structuring a team that you're going to bring together, for instance, to work on an idea. I'm a big believer in diversity, but not diversity as we normally think about it. You know, it's not an issue of, you know, gender, you know, equal men and women or ethnicity or country. Yeah. When I talk about diversity, I'm talking about diversity of experiences, right? If I take a bunch of senior executives and I'll cram them into the room, they're all senior executives. You know, they all have a certain similar kind of experience background. I'm looking for people that are, you know, the young kid in the mail room who's sorting the mail all the way up to a senior executive and everything in between, and people who grew up in different countries, they grew up in different family structures, you know, you were your only child or you were one of 10 kids, because all of that brings perspective to the problem that you're trying. We all come to it with our biases. And what you want to do is you want to make sure that in the process of coming up with ideas that you avoid, you know, a big glaring bias and that you get a broader perspective on the proposals or the ideas. Because the biggest fallacy, you know, most people make, and particularly this is a challenge in small startup businesses, is you constantly think that you are the best representative of your customer. In many cases, you're not the best representative of your customer, right?
Is this a good argument to get out of the office and go and speak to your customer?
Oh, clear, definitely. I mean, you know, Tim was talking about his favorite killer question. My favorite killer question is one that is around this whole concept of, you know, customers and engaging with customers. So the question that I love is, what is it that my customer not like about the buying experience of my product?
Love that question.
Right? And so yeah. for at HP, most weekends, you would find me in a retail store watching customers buy my products from HP.
Mm.
And I would watch them, and they'd look at HP product, they'd look at something else, and they would pick a competitor. Now, why am I doing this and observing this directly? Because there's no market research approach to find these customers, right? There's no way to go say, okay, identify all the customers who looked at my product but chose not to buy it and bought a different product. There's no way to find those people. You have to stand there. So I'll stand there, watch these customers make this selection criteria. Then I walk up, I introduce myself, hand them my business card, tends to freak them out.
I was just going to say, did you ever get asked by security who's the weird guy in the store?
Oh, I get it all the time. I get it from the store managers. But here in Silicon Valley now, most of the retail stores where HP products were being sold, they all know me now. So actually, it doesn't work for me anymore because they see me coming through the door.
Yeah, behind closed hands, it's like, oh, here comes Mr. McKinney again.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Well, okay. So you hand your card over. What happens from there?
Well, then what I tell them is I said, hey, I'm not here to change your mind. Right. What I'm interested in is, can you tell me what your thought process was as you looked at this product but you chose this one? Can you kind of walk me through what your decision criteria was? And so, you know, I did this for 7 years, most every weekend. I'd take my wife, if my kids were visiting, I'd take them, because that way I didn't look like a weird stalker dude.
You know? Well, no, just weird.
Well, if you asked any of my former team members that worked for me at HP, they would definitely put me in the crazy category.
Love it. Yeah.
But you know, so one of the key insights I had, I was down in Los Angeles. My youngest was finishing up his undergrad in LA. And so I was down visiting him for a weekend, Saturday morning. I look at him and say, hey, let's go over to the, you know, in this case, the Best Buy store. And of course, he rolls his eyes like, oh man, dad's going to do his weird store thing again. So we go over there and I do this observation. Store manager comes up like, who are you and why are you standing here just staring at my staff? And then I interviewed the manager and I interviewed the sales team and I asked the sales team, I said, so how are our products selling? And the sales guys go, well, yeah, they sell really great, except nobody over 50 is buying HP laptops now. I'm like, what? Yeah, nobody over the age of 50 is buying HP laptops. What are you talking about? Well, what happened is HP had gone through a redesign in the keyboard deck, the flat area around on your laptop. They went to a design called silver metal. So it's a very shiny aluminum look, including the tops of the keys and everything. And what it was is the glare off of that aluminum was interacting with the bifocals.
Oh, right. Wow.
And they couldn't see the keys. So they would love the laptop, but they would go to a very traditional black, dark keys with white lettering on it, high contrast, so they could see them with their bifocals.
And you would have found that out without going to the store.
Right, exactly. Because what would happen, right? You would see your revenue sales decline. Right? Mm-hmm. All of a sudden, your sales are trailing off in the products being sold at the Best Buy. And what will marketing or sales jump to? Oh, it's not priced right. We need to lower the price. It's Best Buy is not positioning this product correctly. It's got the wrong configuration. We need to put a bigger hard drive. You know, 10,000 other reasons when it was something as simple as this issue. And so I pick up the phone. I called the division, told them what the observation was, and they went through the process and designed out that liquid metal look out of the laptops.